I mentioned earlier, we are in the middle of our journey of Exodus. How are people finding it? In our little prayer before the service this morning, we had at least one person say, I'm really enjoying Exodus. And another person said, I was enjoying Exodus. And we got to a bit where there's lots and lots of details. And it's a book of many phases. Some incredible stories, some great encouragements. And to be fair, some quite boring bits. Today is not one of those boring bits. In fact, I don't think any of the talk's going to be specifically on anything boring, hopefully. And hopefully what we say and what we reflect on and what you talk about together will make some of those bits come alive a little bit more. But I mentioned earlier, yeah, we're in the heart of Exodus. I know some people here might not have been with us for the first couple of talks on Exodus, so let's just refresh our memories as to where we are in the story. We were introduced to this people group, the people of Israel, and they're in Egypt, and they're in captivity there. They're slaves working, and they're crying out to God for help. They're suffering, and they're crying out, and God hears their cry and responds. God comes up with a plan. Then we meet this guy called Moses, who is an Israelite, but is born and then raised in the house of Pharaoh. So unlike the other Israelites, raised in the house of Pharaoh. But he has to flee from Egypt because he gets caught up in this kind of altercation. He kills someone and has to escape. So God finds Moses, this guy, in the land of Midian, which is kind of out of the way, and says, I'm going to use you to respond to the cries of the people. Not just to offer them help, not just to kind of be an encouragement to them, but to save them, to free them from slavery. And Moses, there's a little bit of back and forth. Moses eventually gets on board. And then kind of together, although God does a lot of the heavy lifting, there's works of great power and authority. We see God displays his power, his rule. And then the people are freed. God's plan comes together. And the people are set out of Egypt, and into, as we heard last week, into the wilderness, kind of a desert area. If you're familiar with kind of Middle Eastern geography, well, you don't have to be that familiar. There's a lot of desert out there. And that's what we pick up today. We're going to talk about something that happened in that wilderness, in that desert place, a particularly significant occasion where God issues some commands to the people. Here they're, I say some commands. In all, there's about 613 commands, I think, in the first five books, really, of what we would call the Old Testament. But among that number, there's a passage in Exodus, which we're going to focus on, where there are 10 commands given, the 10 commandments. Now, I'm confident that most people here, whether you've been a Christian your whole life, whether you've never been to church before, you're probably quite familiar with the idea of the 10 commandments. You might even know some of the commandments. Now, I read all sorts of weird things. You might know that. But even I don't sit there and just read through books with laws written down. And I'm going to make a safe assumption that you probably don't either in your spare time to sit and read through books full of laws. So when we come to this chunk of Exodus and other parts of the Old Testament, this is going to be an unusual experience for us. This is not typical reading with kind of some of the stories are narrative-based and that feels familiar. It could be by a great author that we already read. But when it comes to just reading lists of laws and rules and commandments, that's out of my comfort zone. It feels unusual. And my hope, therefore, is that as we read this, we get some questions. This morning, I'm going to be looking at the idea of biblical law as it's kind of given, using the Ten Commandments as a focus point. And I'm going to try and ask a few questions of my own. Primarily, what is the heart of God behind giving these commandments? What might we have missed in this passage, which I've said is so familiar to so many of us? And what do we need to know about the time that these commands were given and the people they were given to that might help us gain a richer understanding of them? So let's begin by reading through this passage, the Ten Commandments, in Exodus 20. It starts in verse 1. Then God spoke all these words. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol, whether in the form of anything that is in heaven or above, a heaven above, or that is on the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing children for the iniquity of parents to the third and the fourth generation of those who reject me, but showing steadfast love to the thousandth generation of those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not make wrongful use of the name of the Lord your God, for the Lord will not acquit anyone who misuses his name. Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. You shall not do any work, you, your son or your daughter, your male or female slave, your livestock, or the alien residents in your town. For in 6 days the Lord has made heaven and earth, the sea and all that is in them, but rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and consecrated it. Honour your mother and father, so that your days may be long in the land that the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbour. You shall not covet your neighbour's house. You shall not covet your neighbour's wife, male or female slave, ox, donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbour. When all the people witnessed the thunder and lightning, the sound of the trumpet, and the mountain smoking, they were afraid and trembled and stood at a distance. So most of that sounds straightforward enough. It's quite clear. Don't do this. Do this. These commandments and others can be made even more simple. We see this in Jesus' teaching in the book of Matthew. When Jesus is asked, which of the commandments is the greatest? Which is the most important? He replies saying, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the greatest and first commandment. And the second is like it. You shall love your neighbour as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and mind, soul and strength. And love your neighbour as yourself. That's the kind of two elements under which the rest of the law can be found. And you can see that with the Ten Commandments, the kind of division as it goes through. We start off with commandments about loving God, how to love God. Have no other gods. We can have no idols. And then the last couple are about how to love others. By not murdering them, or stealing from them, or coveting their possessions. And then sandwiched in the middle, we have this passage about Sabbath. After Easter, we're actually going to do a series looking at the idea of Sabbath. So I won't go into it now. But this, I would say, covers a few things. It's about love for yourself. We might talk about self-care nowadays, but Sabbath as a form of loving ourselves, but also as a profound act of loving God in obeying the Sabbath. So I think even that brief kind of overlooking gives us the impression that Jesus is probably right to say that all the law hangs on these two commandments, to love God and to love our neighbours as we love ourselves, including the Ten Commandments. They can be categorised quite neatly. And we really we have the benefit of Jesus' teaching to show us that. The Israelites, however, first hearing this, didn't have Jesus' kind of succinct synopsis. So what do they make of this? How did the Jewish tradition form around the Ten Commandments and the rest of the commandments? Well, you might have noticed earlier that I said that there are 613 commandments in what we call the Old Testament. Now, I say that not to be pedantic, but to be accurate, in that the language of the Old Testament is something that kind of English and Christian tradition, But that's not what the name this collection of books is known by. Some people might even say the Hebrew Bible. That kind of gives it a bit more clarity. But even that isn't the name that it's recognized by. The Jews, for whom this is their scriptures, call what we call the Old Testament the Tanakh. I don't know if you're familiar with that word. But it's a name which combines three words, which make up the three parts of our Old Testament. First is the Torah, which are the books of the law. These primarily the first five books. And then you have the Nevi'im, which are the prophetic books. We call them the minor and the major prophets. But there are some others that are in there. And then we have the Ketuvim, which are what they call the writings. That's kind of basically everything else. Things like Job, Ruth, Ezra, Nehemiah is in there. So they break down this whole collection of texts into three parts, three categories. Torah, Ketuvim, and Nevi'im. And so it's T, N, K. They go for Tanakh. Now, when it comes to commandments, these are all found in Torah. You might be familiar with the idea of Torah as itself. It's probably more well-known than the other two categories. Sometimes these are described as the books of the law, the books of Moses, or some people call it the Pentateuch, basically just meaning the kind of five books. But this is an example where the essence of something has been lost in the translation. When we think about Torah, we can think about law. Our law in our world looks quite specific. Our culture has a particular relationship with law, law enforcement, example. But a more literal translation of Torah is instruction. So already that's a step away from the law with law enforcement to instruction. Now maybe you're thinking about an IKEA flat pack with a list of instructions. Quick show of hands, who's an instruction follower when it comes to building? Who's a, I'll work around myself. Yeah, there's a couple, mostly men, let's be honest. But a Jewish understanding of instruction, of Torah as instruction, isn't even just a list of instruction telling us what to do. A particular Jewish understanding could be that Torah, instruction, is a way to blessing and a way to salvation. There's a peculiar story that we've just covered in Exodus in our daily readings. So you might have just read this. But in Exodus 15, the people, they're already in the wilderness at this point. We just had the Song of Miriam and the Song of Moses. And they go to a place called Marah, which means bitterness. And they try and drink some water and it's too bitter. And then in Exodus 15, verse 25, it says, he, which I think is Moses, cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a piece of wood. He threw it into the water, and the water became sweet. Now, the word that we have here, translated as showed, has the same linguistic root as the word for Torah, for instruction. And that makes sense. To show someone is a way of instructing them. But this context gives a deeper meaning to the idea of what Torah can be, what instruction can be. Torah, what we call our laws, commandments, can take what is bitter and make it sweet. This is the way to blessing, not just being shown for the sake of showing or instructing for the sake of instruction, but a gift which shows someone their way to blessing. Now, I spend a lot of time with people who aren't Christians and haven't had much experience of church or haven't read their Bible. And it seems to me that a lot of people think of the Bible as a book of rules. Are you familiar with that kind of understanding? Our culture sees Christianity as a group of people who follow a rule book, our Bible. Now, partly that would be because of the way a lot of Christians live and have lived across history. We've lived in such a way which communicates that we follow a rule book. We do exactly what the Bible says, and that's all that we do. And that's what's communicated to people. But the language we use is also indicative of how we interpret the Bible and our theology. When we talk about things like laws and commandments, that communicates something specific to our culture because we have a particular relationship with those words. To command is kind of authoritative. Think maybe some like an army general or something commanding you to do it. But if we follow parts of the Jewish tradition then, which are often much more descriptive and pictorial in how they understand language, we can reimagine this idea of Torah as a gift, or showing us a way to be, instructions not that are instructing us to be authoritative, but instructing us in offering us a way forward. A way that keeps in line with God's values and God's designs for the world. That understanding of the commandments, as we would call them, is equally theologically accurate to think of it as a gift, as a way to blessing. But it's much more accessible. Even our term, I've used several times today, the Ten Commandments. You can equally translate the word commandments as just words or sayings in the Hebrew. This could be the ten sayings, the ten words. We can impose severity on a text by the way that we understand and translate and interpret. Now, this isn't to say that we shouldn't take these things seriously. One thing you know about the word commandment is that you take it seriously. If God is commanding you, you better listen. That's something we'll see in the story of Exodus, what happens when you don't. A gift in our culture is something you might politely accept, but it's ours to do with it as we will. So we're not saying that we shouldn't take these commandments seriously. We are understanding, however, the tone in which these commandments were given, the context they were given in. Now, next week, Ian sharing about covenant. I'm very excited to hear what Ian's got to say. And I'm not going to go into that now. But the idea of covenant that we'll hear about is one way we can understand the context in which these commandments were given. A context which is neither dictatorial or controlling, as some people might think, but rooted in relationship between God and the people. I heard someone this week framing the story of the Bible up to this point as illustrative of an ancient Eastern wedding. I think I'm probably going to write this week's reflection on that, so you keep an eye out for it. But in this picture, where there's kind of comparison after comparison, starting with Abraham receiving a promise as a point of betrothal, or, you know, we talk about engagement, a promise was made. But in this comparison, the giving of law is the exchanging of gifts. It's not the vows or anything like that. You know, it's a giving of gifts. So how can it be that this outlining of specific ways of living and doing things could be considered a gift? Well, when we think about the story so far, we've got this community that was enslaved for 400 years, and there was someone who dictated their lives, someone who commanded them. Well, a number of people, the pharaohs. Now, we've read a little bit about them, but if you've missed out on that, I'll need reminding. They weren't particularly nice. These were self-serving, selfish people who were commanding the Israelites to meet their own needs and not for their own benefit. The way of the pharaoh was not a path to their own fulfillment, to their own flourishing. They're finally freed from that slavery by God. And they're heading towards a brighter future in a new place. A land we're told is flowing with milk and honey. A land where the people of Israel can flourish, can find themselves. But as we looked at last week, one of the perils of the wilderness is chaos. Even now we think about lawlessness as being synonymous with chaos. But as Stephen said last week, for those who are here to hear it, the wilderness was not meant for chaos. So we have God who liberated the people and brought them out of Egypt, a saviour God. And this is the God that offers them a way to live. Out of this potential chaos, issues these commands to bring order for better living. The commands are gifts that are rooted in love and justice as you read them, their bent is not towards control. It's towards making sure that there is equality, there is justice in the land. All people can be treated with love. These commandments bring order, they bring structure, and there is a framework that they set for the people of Israel to flourish. And it is because of his redemptive work that God has the right to command. Pharaoh had no right. God has the right because of what they've done. Let's change gears slightly as we finish. I asked earlier, what was God's heart behind giving these commands? Hopefully, some of the things we said might give you some indication as to what that might be. But what about the other sides? What do we learn about humanity through the relationship with law and commandments? Well, our prerogative as people today is to obey the commands of God for our lives. It is our right, our freedom, really, to come before God, to hear what God is saying to us, to listen and obey. The question then is, what is the state of our hearts as we respond to God? You know, there's been lots of conversation over time about these 613 commandments. Do they all apply to us today? Who are they really for? Is it just something that lives in the past? Some people say, you know, you can categorize them even further into ones that were for that time, some that are kind of timeless. But perhaps more important to us today is that if we believe that God can and does still speak to us, does still guide us, and still offers us better ways to live, do we obey? Now, I believe that God cares about even the smallest details of our lives. God's commands for us and our lives can be gifts to us, ways to blessings, ways to save us from darkness, from selfishness, ways into blessing. And God's voice in our lives can be about the small things and it can be about the big things. One of the challenges by comparison to the book of Exodus is that in this story we see God speaking in a thunderous voice, impossible to miss. God sends plagues to communicate. That's not always the case for us. We can take the opportunity in encountering the voice and the direction and the command of God in our lives and draw nearer to God through them, as Moses does. And we must be cautious. This story tells us about the people who soon after turn away from God. There's fear, there's anxiety, there's doubt, there's confusion. They lose faith in those moments. And we're at risk of the same. So to conclude, here's my three steps, which we can put into practice now as well. Three steps to helping us respond to God's voice in our own lives. Step one, we have to listen. Unless God speaks to you in a thunderous voice, which might well do, we've got to tune in. We have to listen and be prepared. Give the time that it takes to listen to God. There's so much noise and distraction in our world. We might need to go up a mountain, a metaphorical or a literal mountain, like Moses did, to tune in to what God's really saying and to hear God's direction more clearly. We need to listen. Step two, then, is that we need to understand. We can have hearts that are prepared for God's guidance. And that's good. But we can do better than good. We can meditate on, we can learn more about God to clarify where we need clarification on God's commands. Don't be afraid to pray, asking God for clarification. Don't be afraid to ask a friend and say, I feel like God's saying this. That's quite a big step for me. What do you think? Does that make sense? Can you pray with me about that? We can ask for clarification, that's fine. It's good to understand what God's commanding us, to be clear. Finally, step three, we need to act. We are required to do something. Some of the Ten Commandments that we read earlier, you can see them as passive. Don't do this, not doing something. Truth is, these things come alive in the moment when they become a possibility or a viable option. You might never think you'd steal, but if a situation arose where you felt that was your best option, we often hear the example of stealing bread to feed your family or something like that. In those situations where it becomes a real option, being obedient to the command not to steal becomes a choice, an active decision. Even observing Sabbath, which is a practice rooted in not doing anything or not doing certain things, this is an active practice. So what is there then in your life that God might be calling you to obey? And do you sit here today knowing the heart of God behind asking you to do these things? I'll pray now to finish. God, I thank you that you care enough about us, humanity, your creation, that you didn't leave us to lawlessness or chaos or disorder, but you've showed us and instructed us in good ways to live, ways that will bring us more life, ways where we can be who you intend us to be, ways into blessing and into salvation. Thank you, Lord, in the reminder of this story that you desire to communicate with your people. This is true thousands of years ago as it is today. And so for us here this morning, Lord, I pray that you would continue to speak to us. And Lord, I simply pray you would help us to listen, to hear your voice, and to obey. Remove any barriers we might have. Walk with us through any complicated situations where it's difficult to obey you. As we sang earlier, lead us deeper, Lord. And let us put our trust fully in you. Let's have hearts that desire you, to draw closer to you. In your great name we pray.